This is the Alien UFO Podcast, Episode 9, and I'm your host, Simon Bound. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And this is the free version of the episode. The extended episode is 18 minutes longer than this version, and to get access to the extra 18 minutes, you can join the Alien UFO Podcast Patreon campaign. When you sign up for $7.50 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $4.50 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And there are now 9 extended episodes available in the back catalogue, but of course it will grow every week. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free version. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and all the links are in the show notes. And please check out my other podcast. It's called the Past Lives Podcast. There are over 200 episodes. On the Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of the afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. If you enjoy this podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. This week, I'm talking to John Sumple about his award-winning documentary, Extraordinary, The Revelations. The documentary explores the historical significance of ET presence as well as 3 specific paradigms that attempt to define the alien agenda. Guests appearing in the documentary include Richard Dolan, David Jacobs, Melinda Leslie, Nick Pope and Mary Rodwell, and it is narrated by Jimmy Church. Hi John, thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me, Simon. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today.
So I wanted to talk to you about your documentary, which is Extraordinary, The Revelations. And you've done 2 other documentaries leading up to this, the Extraordinary, The Stan Romanek Story, and Extraordinary, The Seeding. And you're going down this pathway, I suppose, which is to do with alien abductions, isn't it? There's stuff about UFOs, which is a lot of people know about, I think, but alien abductions more of a niche sort of knowledge space, and you're bringing more information out about it.
And it's an interesting story to kind of talk about how I got involved in this and my role. And going back 12, 13 years ago, if you had ever asked me that I would be doing documentary films about this subject matter, I would have said no. I would have said, you're crazy. But all it takes is a good story. And I think really what appealed to me as we started going down this journey, one of my producing partners, Jack Roth, creative partner in all the development that we do, is an aficionado, has been doing research in paranormal and UFOs for decades. And he was the catalyst for the opportunities that we had in as far as some of the stories were concerned. And originally he wanted me to tag along with him and another person and be the camera guy documenting a journey throughout the southwestern part of the United States, visiting different UFO hotspots. And that eventually morphed into the opportunity to do our first film. And I was asked to take the lead on as a director. And we were off and running. So I would say that the 3 films are a loosely based trilogy, but they definitely take you on a journey from lights in the sky to being abducted to reproduction experiments to hybrid children to unexplained pregnancies to experiencers meeting their hybrid children, to what's it all about from a timeline perspective, which is really what the focus of the 3rd film is how long has this been happening? Who knows about it? What are the different belief paradigms and how close are we to disclosure? So it's been a 12, 13 year journey to get to this point and sharing this story. And it's been a highly educational one for me.
And have you seen a UFO or have you had any kind of paranormal experiences?
When I was, I lived in Connecticut in the northeast of the United States, and on 3 different occasions when I was a child, in my, I would say, probably 10 to 12 year range, saw UFOs. 2 were the bright lights in the sky. It was at around dusk time of the day, and they moved very rapidly and stopped on a dime. I wasn't the only person that saw those two. Hundreds of people saw one of them. Thousands of people saw the other one and reported it to the local news media. And they were explained that, it's just atmospheric conditions for runway lights at JFK Airport, which was, 90 miles away, which made no sense to anybody who witnessed them. And a third time I saw one with a friend. Sitting on the front porch of my house, we saw a disc-shaped object with red, green, and white lights basically go vertically down into the state park that was in front of our house. And we both looked at each other and said, "Did you just see that?" And we both acknowledged that we did. And then we took off running down the street to see if some friends that we knew were a couple blocks away, if they had seen it, and they hadn't. So it was just between he and I, and we know what we saw, but we're not aware of any other witnesses. So yeah, on three different occasions I have.
How did you feel? Did it get like really freaked out, or was you just excited?
It was more of an excitement thing. My father was a mechanical engineer, and he worked on some projects related to NASA, and he was involved with the touchdown light for the lunar module that landed on the moon, the engineering of that. And as a result of that, I was brought into astronomy at a very young age. And my father was, big time into it. And I was constantly in front of books and television programs at the time where it was space exploration. And it became a little bit of a hobby, passion of mine as well. And I learned at a very early age the vastness of space. And I never really questioned the existence of other beings. And I never have ever seen them necessarily as a threat or something to be frightened of, just another cosmic citizen that we haven't yet met.
So I suppose by having the sightings, it gives you that knowledge, doesn't it? It's no longer theoretical that there's something out there, that you've seen it yourself.
Yeah, I think, yeah, there is that sense of wonder more than anything, the curiosity. And one of the things that we have discussed in our films and as we have promoted them is that we don't know for sure whether or not any of this is true, but what if it is? That's the profound question that we ask as we've gone through these three films, is what if this is all true? And if it is, what do we need to take from it? What is the learning lesson? What is it that we have to be, what do we have to embrace versus what do we have to be frightened of? And I think we've been conditioned that there's a fear element to it, when I don't necessarily know if there is one to begin with, an element at all, or if it's something that we should be fearful of. It's just a big unknown until there's more proof that it exists.
Yeah, and it seems like the Pentagon, should we say, it's released these videos, and I think it said there are 144 sightings and they could only explain one of them. So it's almost like they're starting a drip feed of disclosure. Do you think that's right?
Well, based on some of the research that we were doing and the interviews that we did for the third film, it appears that the U.S. government and military in particular want to change the narrative from UFOs to UAPs, and they want to control the narrative by saying these are the things that are happening. This is what we're seeing. This is what we know. And Nick Pope talks about it specifically in the film, saying language is important. What is said and what isn't said is what it needs to be interpreted. And he said for whatever reason, the United States government has made comments about 2014, something changed. And that's a significant admission that we're tracking these things. We don't know what they are. And they're, Nick alludes to the fact that there's some language that could be perceived as threatening. So they're trying to control the narrative. What does that mean? The big question, I think, is why is there only a focus on these unexplained phenomena? There's a technology that's zooming around the planet that we're tracking, and people aren't aware of what it is, but we're only talking about the technology. We're not talking about any sentient beings that are behind the control of these potential vehicles. So that's the big question that I have is, okay, so we're only going to focus on technology. There might be a disclosure that comes out that's technology focused, but what does that mean about the sentient beings that are controlling these things? So that's the bigger question, is when do we get that narrative starting to percolate into the global consciousness.
And it's interesting they're calling them UAPs now. It's almost like, and I think this might be something Richard Dolan said in your documentary, it's like, if they don't say UFOs, then they can drop that phrase and all the baggage that comes with it and all the history that comes with it. And it's like UAPs is a new phenomena. And it also seems, in a way, it's like the US government releasing this info because it wants to be seen to be in control or to have the knowledge. It's almost like they're worried it's going to come from somewhere else.
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of getting out front in front of it and dictating the release of information and when that is. Well, the New York Times story in 2017 that kind of revealed the whole ATIP program forced their hand. They had no choice but to kind of move forward with what that all meant, because there's a government program that's receiving $20 million in funding. And what is it, and who knows about it, and what are they doing? So these things started coming out, and then we start seeing this backtracking, you know, going back 15 years to things that have been documented and are happening, and there's awareness around it. So there's acknowledgement. In so many ways, disclosure has happened as a result of this saying, there's things in the sky that we're tracking and we don't know what it is. And they're not saying that it's their threats from their countries. They're truly saying that they're unidentified phenomena. And Nick Pope says in the film too that if they wanted to change the narrative to something that it's nothing you need to be worried about, they could have done that in a heartbeat. He said, but they didn't. Not only did they not do it, they brought it up again. Just when it had died down after a few years, they brought up the narrative again and put it back in the public domain. So there's obviously something that's happening in this space that is allowing for the control of information, a slow drip of information, that it just begs the question, is where is this all leading to? And when is that information going to be, is it slowly going to be dripped to the point where when it is revealed, you're kind of like, and there really is a little bit of that right now. You're like, oh yeah, I've seen video like that. That's nothing new. There's a numbness coming to this, because when that was announced in 2017, I think a lot of the insiders in the industry were expecting this big blow up, and it never happened. It was a very controlled narrative, and they dictated what was said and what wasn't said. And a lot of the reaction to it was just kind of, no surprise there. So that means we're being conditioned to a certain extent to accept that there might be something unexplained that we're going to learn more about in the future. And instead of it being something that is this eerie, scary thing that has been kind of dictated in the narrative in the 40s, 50s, and 60s in particular, into something that it's like we have these cosmic brethren that have technology that's more advanced than ours, and we're studying it, and we're going to learn more about it. And as we learn more about it, we're going to introduce it to the public. So it seems very, very controlled.
And it's interesting because it's almost like the like you say in the documentary that UFOs have been around for a long time, and you talk about the ancient rock art, particularly those images that are on the rocks in Australia. They're very compelling.
Yeah, and the one thing that Mary Rodwell says in the film is that they drew what they saw. So that's one thing that I think that if it's not apparent in the film, it's very easy to have a discussion about it, is that we cannot put our current day mindset into the mind of the people of those times, whether it was 40,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, 500 years ago, or even 150 years ago, because we don't know the context. But the knowledge that we have today, when we try to rationalize something or put it in its place, we're using the knowledge of what we know now, not the knowledge of what they knew then. So what they knew then, especially when you're looking at these indigenous tribes all over the world, they're documenting what they saw. They weren't thinking about it as some creatures in a spaceship coming from thousands of galaxies away. They had no context for what the cosmos was in those times. So there was much more of an acceptance probably during those times that this is just a phenomena, that is an aerial phenomena, that's something from the heavens, from the gods, from whatever it is that they believed it to be.
And do you know if there's any kind of ancient tales that describe these visitors as being menacing, or is it all like they are space brothers that brought knowledge?
From what I've understood in the different people that we've talked to, is that it was a sharing of knowledge. Mary Rodwell talks about amethyst stones that the Wangina were educating the Aboriginal tribes about some of the values of the different crystals. So this information came from somewhere. And I think one of the things that there are sociologists, anthropologists who will say, and there's research out there, I can't point to a specific thing at the moment, but that it's the timeline for humans on Earth is not long enough to have the different races that we have. It just, we haven't been here long enough in order for us to have evolved in the way that would allow for these different races of humans. So what does that mean? Where did that come from? That just begs the question of, were we planted here? Were we accelerated here? What technology was used? It begs the question to me, and really the way that I look at it is, how does this earthbound bubble that we live in fit into the cosmic reality? You know, and it's very easy for us to become very earth-centric and think about the earth as being kind of the center of everything. And we don't know that. And if we're not willing to open our mind to the possibilities that there's a lot more out there than we can see, touch, feel, experience, then we're missing an opportunity to say that we're a small part of a great, a much bigger whole. And where do we fit in that? And who do we connect with? And where do we come from? Where are we going? How are we connected to anything and everything that is in the cosmos? And that to me is what I find very comforting, because I feel like we're all part of a grand plan, a grand experiment, a grand experience that we're all connected. And it's more a matter of finding out more. I think we'll find out over the course of the next, you know, 15, 20, 50, 100 years, more about quantum physics, more about interdimensional travel and interdimensional existence, and the ability for us to connect dimensionally, interdimensionally, in ways that we can't comprehend today. So there's in the previous film, in The Seeding, we had Richard Dolan talked about Ralph Waldo Emerson's essay, Circles. And it's a theme that we use throughout the film to basically say that every time we learn something new, it expands the circle of potentially what's out there. And there's exponentially more questions to be answered, to be asked, than that single one or two answers have provided to us that is groundbreaking. So whenever we have a groundbreaking evolution, there's so much more that we don't know, because it increases the potential for our knowledge to learn more about a specific part of our existence. So there were thousands of years ago, the Earth was flat. Hundreds of years ago, the Earth was the center of the universe. And those things were proven to be false. And there was evolutionary thought and science and knowledge that came from the discoveries that evolved from there. So for us to think that it's the be-all, end-all where we are today is nuts. Because in 100 years from now, we're going to be looking back at 2022 and saying, do you remember back then when they thought this? I just think it's preposterous for us to think that everything that there is meant to be at this moment in time. And I think it was back in the late 1800s, 1898 or so, the head of the patent office in the United States said, everything that needs to be invented already has. We've got everything that it will ever need to be invented. That's just really close-minded thinking, that we're the best that we can be. It's never going to be any different than this. It's never going to be greater than this. It's going to be greater. It's going to be different. There's going to be expanse of knowledge and an expanse of technology and science. It's going to take us to a whole different level of existence. I find that interesting and exciting.
It reminds me of that argument that some skeptics have, that UFOs couldn't possibly be visiting us because the distance between the stars, and it's not possible to travel faster than the speed of light. But how do they know? It's like, that's like saying that mankind has conquered all physics and we know absolutely everything, and we can be sure you can't travel faster than the speed of light. But We haven't conquered physics. We don't know that. There may be just a piece of technology around the corner that will change everything.
Well, I think that just even the physics evolution, you have Newtonian physics and Einstein, and there's a new level of physics that's been around for about 100 years that is looking at physics in a whole different way that is, it's not necessarily going to replace, but complement the laws of physics that we currently know. And this new physics, and I think if I pronounce the name incorrectly, my apologies, but it's Al Cubrier who's done this new physics work that is basically showing there's the possibility of bending time and space. So if you were to say the way that we think about linear, we think about time in a linear aspect, we think about travel in a linear aspect. So if you took a piece of string that was 2 feet long and you said and stretched it out and said, well, to get from point A to point B, you have to travel along this string. But what if you took the two ends and bend them together and you could hop from A to B in an instant? That's kind of what is being evolving. And quantum physics is going to take us to a whole nother level of understanding. I think quantum physics will be taught in every classroom in junior high and high school level grades going probably in the next 30 to 50 years. It's going to be something that everybody knows in the same way that we study science and physics today.
I was talking to a guy called Ross Coulthard, who made a documentary. And he has a book out called In Plain Sight. And one of the chapters talks about a guy called Dr. Salvatore Pace. Have you heard of him?
I have not heard that name, no.
He's put in some patents in the States that for anti-gravity and...
Oh, no, yeah, yep, yes. So I have heard of those, yes.
I think the patent office rejected a couple of his things, but then he was supported by his commanding officer at the Navy, saying that these things are real and that the patents should be, you know, accepted, which sounds a bit odd, you know, that where did he get this technology from? Is he a super genius or has he got it from somewhere else?
Well, that technology, I think the anti-gravity technology has been around for almost 100 years. And why has that not been something that has been advanced? Is it a... And if it does exist, you would think that it would be something that would be of value. But I think the bigger part of those questions, and this goes down a whole rabbit hole of free energy and Tesla and control. When you control the flow of cash and you control oil and control the auto industry and you control pharmaceuticals, you get to make the decisions. And if all of a sudden there were things that were free, that wouldn't be a good thing. And I think that's one of the challenges in the evolution of man is that there have always been control mechanisms in place to prevent the rapid evolution to being our best selves and taking advantage of the resources that are available to us in time and space. And it would be interesting to go back in time to say, oh, if we pivoted here and had a sliding door moment and we took the road less traveled, where would we be today? I just find those type of situations fascinating. And there's probably so much information that has been suppressed, not just in the ufology world, but just information in general that has been suppressed because it changes the control, the ability to control the masses and the people who are in those control positions much prefer to be the ones pulling the strings versus having people make their own decisions and do their own things and formulate their own thoughts. And religion plays a big part of that too. Religion has been a control mechanism for centuries.
So if we can talk about a couple of things in the documentary, you have David Jacobs, who has his conclusions about what's going on with the alien abduction phenomenon. Then you have Mary Wadwell, and her conclusions are very different. Why do you think that is?
Well, it was intentional for us when we were making this film that we wanted to bring home the point that there are a lot of people, millions of people in the world who believe that there's lights in the sky, there's sentient beings controlling these craft, there's abduction phenomena, there is reproduction experiments, hybridization programs, hybrid beings. There's no ifs, ands, or buts, but what they believe the end game to be is very, very different. So you have Dr. Jacobs, you have Mary Rodwell, you have L.A. Marzulli and Timothy Alberino in the film talking about the biblical narrative. So we explore in the film, in the middle of the film, Act Two film, is all about these different belief paradigms. They all believe in the same thing, but what they believe the end game to be is very, very different. Dr. Jacobs talks about the end game where they're here to take over. Mary Rodwell talks about the ascension narrative, which is something that most people like to believe because it feels good. They're here to take us to another level. And then the religious paradigm is that there is a biblical narrative that has happened before and it's repeating itself again. And the people who believe that point to the Bible and say the Bible is 100% right 100% of the time, and we're moving down the path to take the sign of the mark of the beast, which is going to be a chip of some sort of technology that's going to bring back the demon presence to take the seat, and then Jesus returns, and it's part of the narrative that they say it has played out before and it will play out again. So how is it possible that we have a fundamental belief in the existence of UFOs and sentient beings controlling them, but the outcomes can be so different? I guess the point that I would make with that is it's no different than somebody who has a national view of what their country is, or a bubble that they've grown up in and a belief paradigm that they embrace. It's what they know. So which one is right is the big question. We don't know. It may be a little bit of everything, but for some of the people that come out with so much conviction and say, I know I'm right, everybody else is wrong, is quite fascinating. And it's one of the reasons why we wanted to document that in the film, is that we're hoping that in viewing the film, people will be exposed to different ideas, but there will also be people who are like, that really resonates with me. So I want to learn more about that. And ultimately what we hope people will do upon watching the film is, you know, hold on to certain elements of it to say, this really struck a chord with me and I need to do more research. I want to find out more about this. So our intention with the films that we have made have been to open eyes. They're intended to be targeted to a wider audience as opposed to pandering to people who already believe in the subject matter. Our objective is to pose questions where people are going to go, I've never thought of that before. I wonder what's going on there. I need to learn a little bit more about it. And probably the best compliment that we had was when we premiered the film at the Pasadena International Film Festival in September. We had a film professor that moderated the Q&A after. And when he addressed the crowd, he said, this is a masterclass in documentary filmmaking because it's engaging. Every second of it pulls you in. There's a lot of information that's presented in a way that it educates you, but it also has you thinking, well, what about this? I need to know more about that. And he said, which was music to our ears, is that people should watch this film at least two or three times in order to fully grasp the content that's in there, because there's so much. And he said, I'm even going to go to, I wrote notes while I was watching the film. I'm going to start to do some research on some of these things because I want to know more. And that was the best endorsement that we could possibly get on the first screening of the film, was to have that element of, I want to know more. I'm curious about what was presented. It comes at you fast and furious. And I need to take it upon myself to do a little bit more research so that I can better understand what's happening. And these are, when we reach audiences of people who are, I've thought about UFOs, or, I'm not quite sure what I believe. And then they see a film like this and it opens up a whole another dialogue, whether it's in their own mind or with other people, but there's a curiosity that has, you know, you've kind of prodded the curiosity muscle, and people want to learn more. And that's ultimately what we're hoping the film accomplishes, is a desire to educate yourself further based on some basic premises that are present in the world today.
And it's a long documentary as well. I think it was about an hour and 40 minutes, which is, I thought that was really good to see.
All three of our films have been around that that length, about hour, in that hour to 42, hour to 45. We don't want to go beyond that. It would be very easy to go beyond that, but we've made it a mantra to kind of keep it at an hour and 45 max, because you're going to lose people's attention span if you go much further beyond that.
And it's good to see that it's that length, because sometimes there are documentaries that are a lot shorter than that, and they try and cram too much in and they don't get enough detail in there.
Or they just stop and you're kind of left holding the bag of, you know, what happened? What am I supposed to do with this? I need more. So, you know, they're not always complete journeys. And one of the things that we've tried to do in our films is present information. In the first film, it was about a one man's journey and his story and how he documented over 180 instances of things that had happened to him. The second film was intended to be an exploration of the unexplained pregnancies and the phenomena itself, but it turned into, as we were doing the interviews, it became very clear to us that the people who've had these experiences feel very isolated. And there's not a lot of compassion towards people who've had these profound experiences. So one of the things that we wanted to make sure audience took away from that film is that we need to listen better. We need to be compassionate. People who've had these experiences need to find their tribe. So, you know, when we were putting that film together, we also put together a resource page on our website for people who are looking for, you know, further information about some of the things that might have happened to them, so we can encourage them to connect and find those audiences. Because when people have had experiences, can't find somebody that they can share it with who can understand what they've been through, it's traumatic. And the trauma gets worse and worse if people keep telling them that there is that their stories are fantastic and that okay, sure, whatever you say. It grinds on them. And probably the most rewarding thing for us, since our first two films came out, we received thousands of messages, a majority of them being emails or DMs saying, thank you so much for making this film. I now realize I'm not alone. I now realize that I'm not crazy. These things have been happening to me for years and I thought I was the only one. That was blew us away, that there's so many people that had reached out to us after seeing the film. Just within the last couple of months, we had two messages from two different women who had seen the seating and said this. As I was watching it, one woman said, I was watching it, I was in tears because I felt like I was watching my life on screen. And she says, I couldn't believe that everything that was happening in the film had happened to me and is still happening to me, but yet there's other people who are having the same experiences. We've been applauded by people who've had these experiences and saying, thank you so much for doing this because it helps normalize the things that have happened to people who've had these profound experiences. And if they can find their tribe and they can have the ability to talk about their experiences with people who can, it resonates with, then they find comfort in that. There's a lot of positive that comes through having the ability to talk through something with other people who've had a similar experiences versus talking to somebody who is just listening and can't really comprehend what you've been through. And that's probably the most interesting part for me as I've gone through this journey as a storyteller, is that I have spent a lot of time with individuals that we've interviewed. So you might see somebody on screen for a matter of minutes, but we've spent hours, if not days, with them to really understand what they've gone through and some of the trauma that they've gone through and the amount of time and energy that they spend grappling with what's happened to them. Some people struggle with it. Some people own it and feel like they're on a mission to help. It's in everything in between. And it's been a very fortunate position as a filmmaker to be in front of people who've had profound experiences and trust you to do justice to their stories. And I think we've earned that respect in the community, that we're less focused on the phenomena and just as focused on the individuals who are having the experiences and willing to give them their due course in telling their stories.
And the thing with the missing pregnancies is where women find themselves pregnant and they might not make any sense to them because they haven't been with a man for a while. And then after a while, they wake up one morning and they're no longer pregnant and they go to the doctor And the doctor might say, what was the procedure you had? There seems to be a lot of scar tissue there, but they haven't had a procedure.
Mm-hmm. And these are, there's some women who have never been with a man before who have been, usually what happens is, these women are abducted at an early age and placed with some sort of biological monitoring device to monitor them. And when they become of age where they're producing eggs, they are harvested. And these are women, you know, by the time they're 18, 19 years old, may have never had sexual intercourse. But like you said, the doctors would be like, how many procedures have you had? And they're like, I have never been with a man. How could I have ever had a procedure? So there are numerous women that we talked to in making of the second film that had stories of the unexplained pregnancies. You know, one woman was a lesbian, had never been with a man, but woke up pregnant one morning and carried for about 3 months, and then woke up another time after an abduction and the baby was gone. So the one of the women that we spoke with for the film said that she'd had it happen to her 27 times, where she knows that she's been taken for the purposes of reproduction experience. And part of it too, for when we were making that film, we're fortunate enough to get people who are willing to go on the record and tell their story, which is amazing because it opened the doors for so many other people to realize they're not crazy. But there were so many people that we talked to that weren't willing to go on camera about their stories. And it was because it would destroy my family if my partner knew that this had happened to me. It would destroy my relationship with my partner because they don't want me talking about this, so I have to suppress it, which is horrible. My family would disown me if they knew that I was like this. I would lose my job. I would be excommunicated from my church. You know, it's all these things that people are like, the fear factor and the trauma that they're dealing with. There's no compassion there. There's nobody that's saying, you know, tell us your story. Let us truly understand it. And let's see if we can help you get the answers you need to continue your journey, you know, on this existence, on this planet, versus saying, shut up, keep it quiet. Don't talk about it. Keep it in its place. So we were fortunate. We talked to over 40 different women who've had these experiences. And so many of them thanked us, even though they weren't willing to go on the record. They said, just thank you so much for listening, because most people don't want to. And that to me has been the most, the humanistic component of all of this is I've developed a compassion for this. And when I first was working on the first film, my thought was, let's do one and done. I don't want to be kind of tagged as somebody who makes films about this subject matter. I don't want to associate myself as a one trick pony in that space. I want to tell other stories. But I realized in making the second film, it was more about the individuals and what they are going through and willing to tell stories in a way that helps people better understand that this is happening, versus focusing on the shiny metal objects in the sky. That's not as critically important to me as much as it is the evolution of humanity. And what we still don't know is important for us to explore and learn as much as we can about what we already know, what we see, but we're not being told anything about. And just encouraging people to keep looking up. And if you see something, share the story. If you have an experience, share the story, because the more people know about these things happening, the more accepted they're going to be. But, you know, if you look in the last 20 years, the belief around UFOs and the existence of beings and hybridization programs is much greater than it was a couple decades ago. So there is this movement towards acceptance, and polls show consistently that the majority of people do believe in UFOs, and a lot of people have had experiences. So let's talk about it.
And how many of the women that you talked to also said that perhaps they were abducted at some point and the ETs introduced them to the hybrid children?
It's all of them. I would say, let me just give you, I'm assuming you're going to do some editing.
They were introduced to them. I've heard that it's because the ETs need the mothers to give them something that the ETs can't give them, some kind of physical connection.
Yep, that's what we heard time and time again. it was specifically about the nurturing component that they could not provide. And it was more a matter of having the ability to connect at that level. And every single one of the women that we spoke with, either in the film or outside of the film, when we were screening different people for that, they all said they had that meeting. They had at least once. Melinda Leslie, who's in the second film and briefly in the third film, talks about meeting her hybrid child when she was young, but also meeting her again years later and the recognition that she had that that was an adult version of what she had seen 20 years earlier. And just the profound moment that that is to realize, oh my gosh, that's my child. And it's what I find, it's hard to express this because most people who are seeing films like this, they're seeing a snippet of time. They're not spending the hours of time that we do in front of the individuals to hear their stories in depth. And it's unfortunate that when you're doing a film, you try to present a lot of information in a way that educates and creates awareness in the greatest way possible, but it doesn't allow you to serve the individual stories in depth. And that's one of the, you know, again, being fortunate in the position that we're in, that we've heard those stories, we've heard the in-depth. So another thing that I should say too is that I mentioned earlier is like, I don't know what the truth is. And I'm not out trying to propagate a lie or advance an agenda. I'm just a storyteller. And I find these stories very interesting from the human perspective and from the almost the lack of awareness perspective, that we just put our heads down and go, and we don't question our existence and where did we come from? Where do we go? Why are we here? It's just, we're on the hamster wheel and we're cranking it out, and we don't take time off the hamster wheel to really think about all those things. And that's part of what we're encouraging to do. People to do. But stepping back a second is, as a filmmaker, I am not like this jump into the middle of the flame when it comes to this subject matter. I have always looked at it from the perspective, I would rather be an outsider looking in as a director than an insider trying to tell a story outward. And the reason why is I'm more curious that way. So I don't do a lot of deep dive research. I have people that we work with on our team that do a lot of that and have the connections to the people. And I like to come at it from the perspective of being, well, I'm curious, I have questions, I need answers, let's talk. And that's really the approach that we've taken, is this curiosity of what possibly is happening, has been happening, and will happen, and address it from that perspective, as opposed to being very dramatic or overly hyping a specific thing or saying this is the truth and I have an agenda here and I want to advance my agenda. Our agenda is simple. What if this is all true? And just to have the conversation and explore the possibilities of these things happening and what do they mean in the context of the cosmos.
In another part of the documentary, you talk about military involvement, and particularly the three military personnel that you talked to. One was in remote viewing, one was kind of crash retrieval, another one was some kind of telepathic communication. And I found the Clifford Stone, what he talked about, to be particularly interesting.
We spent 9 hours with Clifford one day. He lives in Roswell, New Mexico, and we sat in the library at the Roswell Museum and interviewed him. And it's just a fascinating man, and a humble man, an emotional man. He has no desire to tell a lie. His whole thing is like, this happened to me. I think it's important that people know about it. I think that there are people in the world today and historically who have been groomed by the military to take these positions of being kind of interconnector. They connect with these beings. So Dan Sherman was one of the others that you mentioned, who's had the communication with ETs. And he finds out when he's in his early 20s, he's brought into the office of the commander at the base he was at and said, we have a program that we're going to involve you with, and here's the deal. Your mother was part of an experimentation program, and you are the byproduct of that, and you have these capabilities that we need to cultivate in order to have us communicate with ETs in the event that the electromagnetic communications network goes down. He's hearing all this for the first time in this meeting. And he said it was just this profound moment in his life where he's just kind of like, I've been groomed for this. I've been used by the government. And Clifford Stone felt the same way, that he was, his mother was also part of a program. We've talked with numerous other people who have close connections to military bases and children, as children going in for these psi tests, as 5, 6, 7 year olds being connected to these and having these abilities that they're being subject to this testing at a very young age. And a lot of them suppress them and they come up later in life and they're dealing with them as adults. And, you know, it when you hear stuff like this, it's mind bending and mind boggling that governments and militaries and programs exist where they're cultivating the abilities of these individuals to be a part of a program that connects them to the ET existence. It's pretty profound.
And it also suggests there are a lot more people within the military over the decades who've had all sorts of experiences and they've just never come forward.
Well, that the whistleblower component is something that I think we're going to see more and more people having this willingness to talk about, especially as these, you know, layers of the onion are peeled away and more information is being shared. I think we're going to see more and more people having a desire to talk a little bit more about their military experiences. And I think it's important that we realize that the people who have been in these positions, again, need that compassion from individuals. We need to listen. We need to understand what it is that they have gone through and be willing to suspend our beliefs and listen to what their experiences are, because just because it hasn't happened to us doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Yeah. And with Clifford Stone talking about, was it Operation Moondust, where
yes,
that was his job, was to sort of go to crash retrievals.
It's those stories were fascinating. We just shared briefly one of the ones that had happened with him in the film, and it was the first one, and the emotions that he had as a result of it, and just had no idea that he was going to experience what he experienced. And when he was in that moment, he was like, I'm not the guy. Why am I here? Why are you making me do this? And the bottom line was, well, we're making you do this because of your connection, and you're going to be doing this again and again and again. And that was a shock to him and traumatic. And he had PTSD as a result of what he had gone through, but he understood what he had gone through. And he's not the only one that's had PTSD. There's quite a few people who have been through similar type of things that, you know, it's not necessarily that they're in the combat zone. They're dealing with things like Clifford did. And he had numerous situations where he was brought to different locations. A lot of it was crash site retrieval, and had profound experiences. And they're harrowing because you're not expecting it, you know. And he was one of several people that were a part of this. He wasn't the only one that was there. There were entire teams of people that were there, and he was just one member of the team.
Yeah, and we hear about Roswell, and it's a big conspiracy, as though perhaps that's the only crash retrieval that ever happened. But if you listen to Clifford Stone, it seems like it was almost routine. Every few years they would get one.
Yeah. And just the way that he approached it was that, you know, the Roswell was, you know, the most high profile one at the time, and created awareness of the possibilities, and therefore a lot of suppression happened around that, and probably multiple other ones. There's examples, I think, globally that there's governments that have found craft, and there's, you know, are these pictures real? Are they fake? Are they a part of a disinformation agenda? And that's, you know, maybe again, don't know, you know, what the answers are, but it has been a very educational process for me. As I said, I was the outsider looking in and continue to want to be in that role as I look at any film. It's like, I don't know a lot about this. I'd like to know more and take it from the perspective of somebody who might be watching it thinking, well, I have the same questions. You know, I'm curious about this too. What does this all mean? Another thing that I'll bring to the table on this is that over the last 3.5 years, my wife and I have been doing the digital nomad thing. So we both have the opportunity to work remotely, and we've been traveling throughout Mexico, South America. We were in England for a little bit, or Scotland for a little bit, and then South Africa, and now back in Mexico. And during this journey, we've gone to a lot of indigenous locations, indigenous historical and cultural sites, and talk to a lot of the different guides that are a part of the education process. And a majority of them have ancestral connections to the indigenous people that are represented at these historical sites. And every single one of them, and I'm talking at least 15, 16 places that we've gone to, every single one has said, oh, there's an oral history of the Sky people. They're very familiar with it. They don't even bat an eye. I've asked questions specifically about different locations that we've been to, you know, is there technology? Was there education shared? And the oral history that has been passed down generationally is absolutely, and they were familiar. It was not scary. It was an educational process, and information was shared. So we're talking about in Mayan, Aztec, and in the Incan in Peru. Those were all different cultures that had access to information that was presented to them according to the oral history of the people in those locations. That's a film. That's a documentary film, in my opinion.
When you come across these ideas and this, each step you go down, you learn something more. Did you ever come across something and think, oh, no, that's just too crazy for me. I can't believe that's true. But then a few weeks or months later, you start thinking, hang on a second, there's something to this.
I think that the way that I have looked at it is from the point of view of curiosity. And my healthy skepticism, I would say, has been replaced by acknowledging the fact that just because I don't understand something or I haven't had that experience doesn't mean that the individual who's sharing that is lying. I look at it from the point of view is, especially having spent the time that I've spent with the people that we've done the interviews with, I've been with them in quiet moments where they've said to me, I know this stuff all sounds crazy. Do you think I'm crazy? And the conversations always revolve around their truth. So there's so many people like, oh, there's an agenda. These people have an agenda. They want to sell books. They want to be in films. People that are having these experiences are not in it for the money. There is much more ridicule than there is any amount of money that could make that go away. The microscope that they're under, the challenges that they receive, the threats that they receive, the constant scrutiny and ridicule that they receive from skeptics and anybody who doesn't believe them is just, it's profound. And I don't know why anybody would want to come out and tell their story knowing that they're going to be the subject of potential ridicule and slander and just destroying their lives. But I think it's incredible that these people all over the world over the last, you know, 70 years have been willing to tell their stories. And I think that's what we need more of is, you know, we had a conversation with a potential subject matter for a film, and a woman was telling us that our entire town had visitations by beings. And this is back in the mid 90s in the United States. And there were military vehicles, these black SUVs that would show up. There was people that were not identified as military. There were people that were military. There was a presence there for 3 or 4 years where when these crafts came in, that all of a sudden these people would come in to the community. And she said that we get together still to this day, 20 years later, with a group of 60 to 70 people who were present and had the experience. And I said, well, this would be an incredible story to tell. Do you think these people would be willing to go on the record? And she's like, this is a small town farming community, religious community, that nobody would be willing to do this because of how it might, you know, basically ruin their family's reputation. And my point with her was, I said, if you can get 60 to 70 people to go on the record telling the story that happened here, that raises the bar, that raises awareness, that creates curiosity. One person telling the story, you either believe them or you don't. But when you have 60, 70 people who said, I was there, I saw it, these are the things that happened, those are the type of stories I think that when we find them and can bring those to light, those are the type of stories that will help people better understand that this is happening, and it's happening to a lot more people than they could possibly imagine, that they're having these unique experiences all around the world.
So we've been talking about the documentary. It's extraordinary, the revelations, and of course the other two documentaries. So how can people view them? Where will they see them?
The films are available on a majority of the streaming platforms around the world. The best place to find out where they are streaming is to visit our website, j3films.com. There is information about each one of the films, and there are links that will take you to the different sites where it is available for streaming.
Great. And thanks again for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Sorry, my microphone died on me here, and it's sound quality is a little bit different here at the end, but I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, and I've definitely loved having a conversation versus just answering a bunch of questions. It's always much more rewarding, and it's a journey for sure for all of us that are involved in this.
And that was an interview with John Sumple about his award-winning documentary, Extraordinary, The Revelations. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. This is the free 1 hour version of the episode. The extended episode is 1 hour and 18 minutes. If you join for $4.50 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And if you join the $7.50 a month tier, you will have access to an extended episode every week and the back catalogue of extended episodes. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, where you can find my other podcast. It's called the Past Lives Podcast, and there are nearly 200 episodes, and it's where I look into evidence of the afterlife. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regressions. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you are a patron, you'll get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call that can be booked on my website. My Instagram is Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word, and on Twitter I am at Simon G. Bowne. And if you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.